This has been an interesting summer for me. I determined that I wanted to spend the first part of the summer not in La Grande and succeeded. We took a long trip, as you know, to Montana and Wyoming and like that. Then in the middle of the summer, I did a teaching tour down in the San Francisco area at a couple of Zen monasteries. And the what I was teaching, I thought about quite a lot before going there, because Kayla and I have a long history in these locations. We both lived there, and in fact, the first time I ever even saw Kay was in a Zen monastery that she was living in, but her head wasn't shaved or anything. She had lots of blonde hair still. Anyway, so it was very pleasant to go back. But going back and seeing old friends and sort of Dharma compatriots after a long time, I thought really seriously about what it was that I wanted to say and share with people after having been away for such a long time. And so what I was teaching down there was on my mind throughout the summer before we went down there, actually. And as it turns out, it's been on my mind ever since we came back a lot also. So actually where I wanted to start here this fall is where I left off, more or less, in San Francisco in the beginning of August. So that might seem a little bit strange, because I'm going to start out with a kind of a Zen story. But what I want to lead into from that is to talk about something very basic in Buddhist teaching, which is sometimes called interdependence or dependent origination or causality or something like that. And I want to work with that theme for a while because it's really important. In fact, in some of the oldest of the Buddhist teachings, which are the recorded dialogues of the Buddha with various of his students, so that's now over 2,500 years ago, there's a place in the sutras, which is what those recorded teachings are called, where he says, if you see the Buddha, you see dependent origination. And if you see dependent origination, you see the Buddha. Which is to say, the essence of what he knew and what he was about was in this teaching of dependent origination, that it was actually central, critical, and essential. And when you first hear about it, it seems ridiculously simple. Like, how could this be? It's basically the Buddhist version of causality. But it has subtleties in the way in which the Buddhists look at dependent arising or dependent origination. These are different ways of talking about it. Or interconnectedness, it's another way of all saying the same thing, because there's no real good way of translating the Sanskrit for what this term means into English. But anyway, it's very central, and it has a lot of depth to it. And there are many different kind of practices, mindfulness practices, meditation practices that can be associated with it. So I want to look at those as the weeks and the months go forward. And so that'll be our theme for a while, until we either get bored of it or sick of it, or I run out of things to say, which could be quickly, you never know. So let me begin with a Zen story. Okay. So you may have heard that in the Zen tradition, there's something called a koan. Has everyone heard this? A koan, which is sort of like a in a sense, it's considered like a nonsense statement or a nonsense dialogue. Like, when I was young, the most famous koan that we all knew as beatniks, because that's how old I am, that when I was young, I was a beatnik. Right? I was a beatnik before I was a hippie. That's how old I am. What is the sound of one hand clapping, right? I mean, that's kind of like, You know, so but the idea of a koan is that you think about it and you wrap your mind around it in a way that kind of, we used to say it locks up your mind so you stop thinking, but it does more than that. It kind of reveals itself on more and more subtle levels, sort of like a flower that's opening up, and it's continuously opening up, and there are new petals on the inside, and then more petals and more petals. I think that's a better example than an onion. But that's an okay example, too. So these koans, actually, in many cases, are people's remembering dialogues that they heard between Zen masters and their students, and they shared these with their own students over the years because there was something about this dialogue that was really important. I mean, for example, something that we'll come to is a short dialogue that the Dalai Lama had with Kay and myself that has really informed my practice for 20 years now. You know, he basically said one simple thing, but I've been working with that one simple thing for 20 years because when somebody of profound spiritual attainment says one simple little thing to you, it kind of just goes down and down and down and on and on and on. It's like I remember somebody, Gary Snyder, the poet, had written a poem about the world being on the back of a turtle or a tortoise. I don't know, a turtle, I think. Turtle Island, right. And because that was the Native American view, that the world was held on the back of a turtle. And somebody said, well, so what's the turtle standing on? And he said, it's turtles all the way down. So the thing about these deep kind of comments, these deep kind of teachings, is it's like they go all the way down. And underneath the turtle that you find, there's another turtle, and then there's another one, and then there's another one. And they're always getting much more profound. So that's why over the years, these koans have been transmitted from teacher to student, and they've been used in practice so much. So the one that I'm going to be talking, that I'll share with you, and that I was talking about at San Francisco Zen Center in August, it's something that probably, it's a dialogue that probably took place around 700 AD in China. And the way the story goes is that one of the Zen patriarchs, the sixth Zen patriarch, Kuai Neng by name, and this is a legend, by the way. I mean, it may or may not have happened. Okay, no way to know. So maybe it did or maybe it didn't. It doesn't make any difference. So Kuai Neng shows up at this monastery, and nobody knows who he is. They think he's a bum, basically, and he's sleeping under the rafters. And he hears two monks having an argument. And the argument that they're having is about this flag that's flapping in the wind. Now, in these old Zen monasteries in China, when there would be a public Dharma teaching, sort of like what I'm doing here, they'd go outside and they'd hoist a flag so anybody that wanted to come would know, hey, there's going to be a teaching at the monastery, so you can go to the monastery and hear it. So Kuai Neng overhears these two monks and they're having an argument. And it's this bizarre argument. One monk says, the wind is moving, because they see this flag flapping. And the other monk says, no. The flag flaps on its own. The wind doesn't make it flap. And they're going back and forth about, you know, is the wind moving? I mean, this is the way it's actually translated. Is it the wind that's moving or is it the flag that's moving? Now, mostly when people hear this statement, they think, you know, this is ridiculous. We know what this is about. How could they be arguing about this? But Kuai Neng shows up and he looks at them and he says, not wind moving, not flag moving, mind is moving. And in some translations, it's even nicer because they say, is the flag flapping or is the wind making the flag flap? And Kuai Neng says, neither, your mind is flapping, which, you know, sort of gives a different sort of turn to it. So translating is nice that way. You can sort of play with ideas, and who knows what the actual thing was. But anyway, so their jaws drop, and then he walks away. So that short vignette the two monks arguing, and then Kuaneng saying it's the mind that's moving, is this thing that Zen monks have been meditating on now for 1,300 years. And you think, wow, how is that possible? I mean, is there enough in there that you can meditate on that for 1,300 years? Well, there is. So, in the first place, and this is a little bit of an aside, these two monks weren't stupid. I mean, it sounds like a pretty stupid argument, you know, which is it? Because actually it's a philosophical argument about causality or dependent origination. And the argument is really along the lines of when something moves, it's about agency. What's the source of that movement? Is it within the thing that's moving, or is there an external something that causes it to move? That's really what they're talking about in the abstract. And the flag is just the example. Because these are old Zen monks. I mean, they weren't stupid. They understood the mechanics of wind and flags. So they weren't arguing about that. They're having a But Kuaneng says, no, it's the mind. And their jaws drop. Because he said something that's very unusual. So what's happened here is he's reminded them that in their experience of anything that's going on, there's the objective thing that's going on, but then there's what does the mind do also, and that those two things are not separable, that there is no experience on its own that doesn't include our own minds. And why is that? That's because our experience of the world is a representation. And he's reminding people of the perceptual process. And so that's what I want to go to this evening, because it's a basic and fundamental Buddhist teaching that the Buddha does not teach from the point of view of a revelation, as in, oh, I was sitting on a mountain and the sky opened up and I saw something and wow. Or, you know, I got hit by the old cosmic whatever on the back of the head, or an angel came down and talked to me. I mean, that's revelation. And that's very important in many religions. I'm not putting down revelation as saying it's not important. But that's not where the Buddhist teaching comes from. The Buddhist teaching comes from looking at what is the experience that we have right in front of us. What's the experience that we have as human beings right here, right now? And what is it about that experience that either frees us or entraps us and binds us, that either makes us happy or makes us unhappy, that leads to good outcomes or leads to unhappy outcomes? So that's what the Buddha cared about. In his teachings, in his lifetime, he refused to talk about anything else. People asked him all sorts of questions, and he'd either sit there and not answer, maintain a noble silence, is what we find in the scriptures, or he'd say, why are you asking me that? What difference does it make to you whether or not Brahma created the world or Indra created the world? Does that matter to you? What matters to you is you're sitting here and you're not happy. And that makes you unhappy, that you're unhappy. So what do we do about that? Isn't that what really matters? Yes. Okay, so forget about who created the world. He never said that there wasn't somebody or something that created the world. He just said it doesn't really make any difference to you in the here and now, really. So, it's like back to the flapping flag and the mind that's flapping. Okay. So, what the sixth patriarch has said is, look, let's look at what experience is and how does experience work, which is basically going back to the Buddhist teaching. So, to go back to the basic teaching. So the Buddha started out by saying, let's look at our experience. What is our experience, really? Because if we look at our experience, then we'll find out what's going to give us peace of mind. And if we don't look at our experience, we're never going to find peace of mind. It's what, in the traditional sense, is called nirvana. You've all heard the word nirvana, which sounds like a big highfalutin something, which actually it is. But it's really essentially just getting peaceful. And getting peaceful by removing stuff that gets in the way of getting peaceful, not adding stuff. And this is where Buddhism gets a little bit subtle and difficult for some people. Because we live in a world where we think in order to get what we want, whether it's peace or happiness or everything else, we got to add something. I need this. I need to do that. I need to acquire the other thing. I need to be doing this. But the Buddhist way is much more like, oh, no, you've been doing all that stuff. Did it really work for you to make you happy? What we really need to be doing is getting rid of the stuff that's standing in the way of being happy. Get rid of the stuff that's standing in the way of being peaceful. And most of that stuff that's standing in the way of being peaceful is the clutter in our own minds and the confusion in our own minds. So that's where we have to look. So he said, so let's look. What do we find? The Buddha says this. Let's look. What do we find? So he says, well, we find that all of our experience is based upon our sense organs. That we know everything, that everything that occurs to us fundamentally is based upon sensory experience. Now, before you say, wait a minute, there's some other stuff, let me talk about the Buddhist idea of sensory experience. First off, there are what we know of as the five senses, but what Buddhists would call the five physical senses. That we have eyes and we see things. We have ears and we hear things. We have a nose and smell things. We have a mouth or tongue and taste things. And we have a body that lets us feel things. Touch, feel things. Okay. And that, to use the example of seeing, if we look at what goes on when we're seeing something and we analyze it, what we recognize is the fact of seeing something, like my seeing this cup, actually in seeing this cup there are three elements that have come together. There's my eye, which is the physical organ which allows me to see. There's the objective thing out there, which is seen, whether it's a physical cup or light, in fact, bouncing off of a presumptive physical cup, but it meets my eye, so what's actually going on is light is meeting my physical eye. And there's a moment of consciousness. I'm aware of what's happening. So in every moment of sight, three things can be seen. Well, that's bad. In any moment of sight, three things can be understood as having come together. An external object, a sense organ, which is the eye, and consciousness, awareness. And those three things are completely wrapped together in our experience. In a moment of sight, we don't notice that those three things are going on, but if we step back and reflect on what's happened, we know it's true. We're all educated. We all went to high school and college, and we took some physiology courses. Some of us took a lot of physiology courses. And we know how vision actually works to some degree, at least to the degree we know that those three things do come together. And the same thing can be said for hearing. Mostly, we don't think about it, but the truth of the matter is there's something external which creates vibrations in the air, which makes the tympani move, which is the physical sense organ, which then those things come together in a moment of consciousness. Then we have a sound, we hear a sound. Those three things have to come together. If we're sound asleep and we're not dreaming and we're in dreamless sleep, they say that the sense organs are not functioning at that time and we're not aware of anything. Right? The senses are sort of paralyzed. So it doesn't matter if somebody's walking down the hall, if you're deeply asleep, you won't hear them walking down the hall. If you're not really deeply asleep, you might. But if you're deeply asleep, you won't. So that goes for all the senses. Now, the place where the Buddhists diverge from Western thought, however, is in what they call the sixth sense organ, which we call the mind. See, now, in the West, in the modern world, we think of the mind as this active something which is engaged and doing stuff. You know, like, my mind is analyzing this. That's the way our language works. My mind is doing this other thing. Of course, when you try and find your mind, if somebody asks you to find your mind, which some Zen masters have done, you're going to have a problem. Where is it? We say, well, it's not physical, so I can't point to it. Yeah, well, try to identify it in some other way. I go down this line with my university students and drive them crazy because they realize they can't find it. They thought they knew what it was, but when I really press them, it's like, no, they can't find it. It really bugs them. The Buddhist view is that what we call the mind is actually just another sense organ. I mean, and if you think about this from the point of view of mere subjective observation, you can see how they come to this. That way of categorizing all the senses of an object, an organ, and a consciousness associated with that object and that organ, that works for the mind also. Because the objects of mind are what we call thoughts or sensations, perhaps, or memories, we might say, or feelings, we might say. There are a lot of things that we would throw into the lump of what are considered the objects of mind. They're all non-material internal phenomena, if you will. And the Buddhist view is that it's like we have a sense organ that's aware of those non-material things. So then there's a moment of consciousness, then there's that sense organ of the mind, so it's passive, which is the main point, is that what they call the mind is actually a passive sense. And then there are all the objects that are there, and those three things are conjoined in every moment of what we call a mind or thinking or thought. Now, if you meditate and you look really closely at your experience, you can actually start seeing that this is true. But it takes a while. You have to sit still for a while, and you have to have a certain point of view. Because it's not like your mind is going to stop functioning. We know that it won't. This is another experiment that I like to do with my students. I say, how long can you go without thinking? And first, before we do the experiment, I say, raise your hand if you think you can go 10 seconds without thinking, and a few will raise their hand. And I say, 5 seconds without thinking, and just about everybody will raise their hand. I'll say, okay, now let's do the experiment. On my mark, watch until you have your first thought. And usually it's about 1 second. It takes about that long, and the first thought pops in. So watching the thoughts is no problem. They're there. But if you spend your time only watching the thoughts, rather than believing that you are thinking the thoughts, then the internal experience changes. Because what you start noticing is the way all the internal experiences start depending on each other. And you can start noticing how internally what's happening is sights and sounds and thoughts and physical feelings, and if you were really paying attention, smells, possibly even tastes, all come together to create the moment of experience. Each moment of experience is constructed out of all those perceptions coming together. And I said you could possibly even taste something in the moment. So do you all remember Margaret Mead? She was a famous anthropologist of our generation. My students have never heard of her, of course. She used to say that she could walk into a room and she could taste what was happening in the room. She could taste the vibe, what I would call the vibe of an audience. That particular sense organ for her did not require food to be active in the way we think of food. So this is true. I worked for her daughter. I knew her. She really could do this. It was one of her unusual skills. So our reality is actually constructed of all those bits, although on a moment by moment by moment by moment by moment basis, we don't notice that. And we don't notice how all these parts hang together. But it is possible to see how this works in meditative practice. Now, in the Buddhist sense, why you might want to see how this works or understand how this works, there could be different explanations for why you might want to. If your mind is driving you crazy, that could be one reason why you might want to see how this works. Because if you think of yourself as being kind of a victim of your own mind or being carried forward by your own mind, then you need to find a way to separate yourself from that and recognize that your mind is just operating like any other sense. And if you recognize that, then it won't necessarily always carry you. It's powerful, so it usually will. But you can get moments of being free from the domination of your own mind. And then that has various interesting consequences. I walked into, when I was working in IT, the guy who was running the department was a network administrator. And I sat down in his office one morning, as I often did, and we were sort of shooting the bull. And I said something to him about, well, I was talking to so-and-so and so-and-so about something. And it was, I just looked at him and I said, well, you had that thought, but does that make it true because you thought it? Do you believe everything that your mind tells you just because you thought it? Does that mean it's true? I mean, from my point of view, obviously everything my mind thinks isn't true, because if everything my mind thought was true, I would know everything. And I'm wrong most of the time. So obviously my mind is not telling me the truth all the time. That seemed pretty self-apparent to me. I said, so this guy said, you know, never occurred to him that his thoughts might be wrong. And JJ, who was my boss, looked at me like, uh-oh. He said, gee, it never occurred to me either that my mind might be wrong. I thought, university administrator, you should know better. You are not going to be right all the time. Well, anyway, the point is that usually we believe what our minds tell us. And because we believe what our minds tell us, whether they're correct or incorrect, we're enthralled to our minds. So how do we free ourselves from our own minds? This is what Huineng was saying to the two monks, right? Your mind is what's flapping over here. And you need to look at what your mind is doing. That's really what the Buddhist path is about. It's not about, is the power within the flag or the power within the wind? That's an interesting philosophical argument. But if you want to be free, and if you want some peace of mind, you're not going to get it that way. The way you're going to get it is by understanding how your mind is involved in this process. And what is your mind doing? So this way of thinking about how all the parts depend on each other, and this is my point, this way of thinking and understanding and recognizing how all the parts depend on each other and having the ability to sit still long enough to look at that process is then a place where we are naturally, by looking at that process, standing back from it a little bit and automatically in those moments being a little bit free from it. And getting a little, what we would call, peace of mind. I mean, it's interesting that that's the English term. We don't just say, I'd like to have peace. We say, I'd like to have some peace of mind. Right? It means peacefulness from our own mind. Like, leave me alone for a while, please. You know, so we can get into that space. Now, there are different ways to get into that space. Sometimes you can get into that space by doing the sort of thing that Kay will be leading us doing, a guided meditation, which is you send your mind down a certain track, and when your mind tries to jump off of that track, you pull it back. Right? So instead of thinking about the fact that I have a stack of bills that is, you know, 3 inches high, but I've got money that's only an inch and a half high, you know, right? It's like, I'm not going to think about that. I can go back to this other thing. Right? And if you can be successful at going back to this other thing, that's one way of getting some peace of mind. Especially if what the other thing is a theme of reflection on your own nature rather than a theme of reflection on some crazy stuff going on in the world. So if you're meditating on your own Buddha nature, for example, so we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but if you meditate on your own true nature as a peaceful, wise being, right, then that's a way of freeing yourself a little bit from the domination of your own mind. But there are other ways to do it also. Like a Zen technique would be to meditate on the sound of one hand clapping and drive yourself into mind lock, and then that will sort of get you free of things. And another way is to just constantly step back from each moment that your mind goes someplace so that you're in control, whatever you is, which is another issue. But the mind, at any rate, is not in control. Let's just say that. Instead of the mind being in control, something else is in control. And then there's some peace that can be found that way. Now, one of the things that I'll talk about as time goes on is the difference between being, as they say in the Zen tradition, on the cushion and off the cushion, which is to say, what can you do where you're actually sitting and practicing meditation, watching your mind, being free from your mind, working on a specific theme, versus what can you do when you're walking down the street taking Pucho, you know, your dog, for a walk, or driving your car, or going to Safeway and buying some groceries, or whatever the case may be. So there's on the cushion and off the cushion, which are different kind of practices, because you can't really do the same thing unless you're a really great practitioner. Like our lamas can walk down the street, can sit on a meditation cushion, can be reading a book, can be in the dentist's office. They're all in the same place all the time. It doesn't make any difference. They can do that. But, you know, they've been practicing meditation 8-10 hours a day for 40 years. And they're experts, and they were talented when they started, or else they wouldn't have gotten to where they were anyway. And then there's us, you know, and us are, I meditate every morning, sometimes successfully and more often than not. But, you know, when I'm driving down the street, I'm not meditating. It's probably a good thing, because that would be tough on my insurance if I were doing anything else. So that's where we'll go. That's sort of the prologue to what I'm thinking about we'll be doing over this next period of time. But remember, it sounds relatively simple. Maybe it doesn't sound that simple, but at some level, it might sound relatively simple on the superficial level, but it's turtles all the way down. There's always something underneath and underneath and underneath. And a lot of it reveals itself only in your own experience. It's not going to reveal itself because I say something that, oh, wow. I mean, I might. But mostly, it's if you bring it into your own practice and you're successful with it, then you'll see something, you will hear something, you will know something, and that's where the understanding comes from. In the medieval European world, there was a big argument that was going on, and I think it might have involved Aquinas. My Western philosophical training is not very good to be able to say this, but the big question was, is the truth something you discover, or is it something that's within you that needs to be revealed? And the scholastic philosophers argued about this. Do you find it out there? Do you work on it and discover it out there? Or do you uncover the truth which is already within you, and you simply need to reveal itself? So the Buddhist answer to that is both, naturally. But the point is, at least one half of it is the internal thing reveals itself to you. And the external thing is, that's why you study. That's another aspect of dependent arising, that you get the right thoughts in your mind by studying and analyzing and whatnot. But that's part of it. The other part of it is, there's already something natively and naturally within you that has the capacity to know and see the truth. If you can mobilize it so that it is there to see and to know. So that's what meditation practice would be about. And we'll kind of work on that stuff.
Can I just add something?
Yes, but I better give you the mic because of that truck out there.
Okay. Well, you don't have to be there. It's not that important. I know.
that when we went to see Zatujay Rinpoche, which is one of our teachers in that comes to Yakima occasionally. Some of you met. And when he was one of the techniques David was talking about was stepping back from the mind. And Zatujay presented a kind of a charming way to look at it, in that he said, the mind is very mischievous and it delights in telling stories. I mean, that's what it loves doing all the time. You know, every moment it delights. And that you just have to help. One of the helpful techniques is just to recognize that that's what's going on. That if the mind is just delighting in running these stories nonstop, and every little stimulus will bring up a new one and trigger memories and new stories, and that you just have to realize that that's what it is. It is a story, and it's not necessarily reality. And that if you can kind of find that distance between the stories that are being created, a little space in there, that you'll have a chance of maybe tasting what the reality of the situation is. That's a lot of what mindfulness practice has to do with, which every year in the fall I'm always harping on. We have to do mindfulness practice. And those are just little practices, you know, like stopping every once in a while and taking a breath, like literally just stopping, taking a breath, giving yourself some distance from the story, or stopping, one of Thich Nhat Hanh's techniques, stopping and doing a half smile, you know, giving, that's another space, just a moment of space to give yourself some distance between the story that's running and a reality check. And then, do you want me to go on and, do you want to, should we shut it off? You said you were going to shut it off before I talked about the water. Or do you want me to do that?